This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
From food insecurity. The Garden is a community-led effort to build self-sufficiency and a sustainable option as food prices skyrocket. The rate of maternal mortality in Sierra Leone is reported to be 8 in 1 women. You'll be contributing to a better environment, helping the people of Fifth Ward here in Houston have access to wholesome fruits and vegetables, and supporting the women of Sierra Leone to reduce the level of infant and maternal mortality. Come on out to KPFT and bring those cell phones collecting dust on your shelves and drawers. This is KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Valinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
Brian Levinka.
And Glenn Holt. And on tonight's show, when Houston florist David Moncrief threw an evening cocktail party for a few friends in his living room in the spring of 1954, he was unaware that he was in the process of making gay history. After all, they were only going to watch the Academy Awards show on television. Well, now it's 57 years later, and the Diana Foundation is the nation's oldest active gay organization. Brandon Wolf will join us to tell us their story. On News Wrap, ugly actions against black congressman and openly gay congressman Barney Frank mark the Tea Party's last gasp protests against U.S. health care reform, while a GOP senator's effort to repeal D.C. marriage equality fails. And a Georgia high school honor student, Derek Martin, got his school's okay to bring his boyfriend to a senior prom, but then his parents threw him out of the house because of the media attention. Easter in Houston means more than the bringing of spring. This weekend has become a major community fundraising event over the years. Two organizations contribute to make the effort, Bunnies on the Bayou and Bayou City Boys Club Jungle Party. Representatives from both of those organizations will be here to talk with us about the coming weekend. And coming up Thursday, April 1st, Bayou City Performing Arts will host their fourth annual Just an Auction at the Alley Theater. This is an annual event. It has live and silent auctions featuring a large collection of artwork by well-known local artists, as well as all manner of sort of donated goodies and vacation packages and things. Sid White is going to be our guest to talk about that in our second hour. And also in the second hour, a look at a new GLBT business in Houston competing in the world of online video rentals, and the feature segments from This Way Out. Tonight, those features include an interview with the author of Concord, Virginia, A Southern Town in 11 Stories, and Audiophile with J.D. Doyle. That's tonight on Queer Voices.
But first, Barbara Walters was right.
Well, how so?
Tell us. Ricky Martin is gay.
Now, I hope everyone was sitting out there when they got the news because of this shocking revelation in the GLBT community. But, no, does it matter now? I mean, really?
No, but isn't it nice that young people have a role model to look up to?
Well,
and somebody that is so popular and has done so much, especially in the Spanish-speaking language world, that there is a positive role model who's raising two kids.
Exactly. And he came out on his website, so it, you know, publicly, you know.
Unless somebody hacked into his website.
Well, I don't think that would make a difference. I think the truth is still what happened today.
Apparently, he was in the process of writing a book about himself.
That's what I heard, yeah.
And he realized there's no way he could write this book without him revealing that he's gay. Mm-hmm.
So La Vida Loca is really loca, I guess.
I guess so, yes.
So clever. But, you know, it's important because so many of us are... the GLBT community, we have kids, we have families, and that's not brought out enough, and it's good to see someone like himself, high profile, who says, you know, yes, I'm gay, but I'm rearing children.
We're moving towards a point where it doesn't matter who you are, where you come from, if you're part of our community. Just, you know, the more people that come out, the better. Harvey Milk said it best, come out, come out, come out.
Yes. And scare the Tea Partiers to death.
The Tea Partiers. Boo hiss.
Okay, well, let's get on with our show.
Okay.
Title song from the album called For Your Entertainment. That was For Your Entertainment by Adam Lambert on a private label release from 2009. This is Queer Voices.
The current issue of Outsmart has two really good articles, and we've pretty much talked about the one of them, which is about the caucus. But the other one is their cover story about the Dianas, which is now 57-year history. Started in 1954, which is a very favorite year of mine. It's the year that I was started. But I wasn't a member.
So now we know how old you are, Jack. I never knew.
Well, it's I'm pretty old.
I don't know.
And it's just a wonderful article. This is only part one, and it's actually just a quarter of actually what was written. You can go to the OutsmartMagazine.com website to read the entire article. And Brandon Wolf and Chris Dolby is here to talk about working on this story, putting it together. And first of all, what was the idea of doing this comprehensive story?
Actually, it didn't start out to be comprehensive.
Oh, okay.
I was supposed to turn in a 2,500-word story, and I went and did an interview. I knew they were the oldest group in town. Didn't realize that they were the oldest in the country. I found that out later.
I didn't know that either. That's impressive.
they weren't the first. Like, Madison was there before, but Madison and One Incorporated were there before, but they've closed down.
As many organizations have closed down from the early days.
But this is the one that's been continually active the longest. I was especially interested in finding out about the 50s and 60s.
Right.
Because I came out in 1970. I'd like to know what happened before I did.
Especially here in Houston, where you think it's so provincial.
Exactly.
I can't imagine, you know, how secretive it must have been, and, you know, everything was kind of kept down on the down low, air quotes, and how they survived.
Incredible.
The oppression, and the arrest, and the bar raids, and everything.
Well, actually, that was sort of the reason why it did start it, because it was done in people's homes.
Mm-hmm. And even when they had parties in homes, actually, there wasn't much bar life back then. Most of gay life was in homes. And when you came out, you know, somebody took you to a party, and then if you were personable enough, someone would say, I'm having a party, and then you got invited. But they were also very careful that they just didn't have... They were also very mixed, the lesbians and the gay men.
Yeah, that was an interesting part of the story.
Because they didn't even want the neighbors to see a whole bunch of men or a whole bunch of women going into a house for a party.
So that sort of forced men and women to work together.
It did. And most of them...
Or at least socialize, at least.
Actually, yes. Most of these people still have lifelong friendships. What they did, that they paired off into boyfriend-girlfriend relationships that were fake.
These quote-unquote beard?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except that, well, I kind of think of a beard as being a straight woman, but it was like, you know, a gay man and a lesbian paired off with each other.
A pink beard. So to speak.
Very well put.
I guess this also sort of helped them in, like, corporate functions at work.
Oh, absolutely.
So how did you find out, where did you get the information?
Well, I had a lot of difficulty. When I first started out, nobody could get me beyond barely into the 70s. Everybody wanted to talk about the 80s, the big glamour days in the Tower Theater, which were incredibly glamorous. But I just couldn't seem to break through. And then the lucky break I got was I had done a story about Sandy Bubbert, you know, who owns Katie and Baker's. And done a profile of her. And about a month after that, I was in her restaurant eating. She said, what are you working on? I said, well, I'm working on this Diana story. And she asked me how it's going. I said, well, I'm really kind of discouraged because I just can't break through to the 60s or 50s. And she said, oh, I know Johnna Mueller. She was at the first party.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
And I said, is she still alive? She said, sure, she's alive. She lives out in Sugarland. You want to meet her? So she hooked me up with Johnna, and then she gave me some more names, and then I called those people, and then they started calling people. What had happened was before I had limited myself to current Diana members.
Right.
And so there was this whole network of people that finally started opening up and telling me stories.
And of these people in the early days who are still alive, are they out? Would you consider them out, or...
Actually, I would say the majority of the women aren't.
Really?
I talked to probably six women, and they all told me I could not use their names.
Really?
I couldn't even imply anything that would show. Now, Johnna, as a matter of fact, was honored at Diana 57 Saturday night. They gave her a special award and brought her back as, you know, having been at the first party.
Wow.
She's out.
Chris, how did you get involved in working on this?
I became involved, I think, where to start out with just plain proofreading. Look this over and see if it needs to be proofread, because I was a book person at a bookstore, and I have a whole lot of literary background. But it soon escalated to let's try to find where this originally happened. Let's go find 3600 Louisiana Street. Let's see what's at 3600 Main Street. Let's go take photographs for the... And we took photographs. We stood in the middle of the Main Street and dodged trains. This was in the middle of the summer. It was hot. We were red.
Well, one of the things that you say in the story is that the spur, the 527 spur, wasn't even there at that time.
Right. The man who owned the original development, where it was a whole block where he put in French-style houses.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which, it's hard to believe that Houston had a French Quarter at one time. But it did. It's down where Brennan's
yeah, exactly.
were.
It's kind of still there, a little
and
taste
if you,
of it.
If you, yeah, if you go up and down Main Street and some of the side streets, you see the French grill work. And there were a lot of Greek statues that they incorporated in this first enclave where they had the first party. And you even can look in yards in that area and see other people that had, I don't know whether they stole all these or they just bought them at some kind of auction at the end, or whether they installed them themselves at the time. But there's Greek statuary in the neighborhood.
You know, this sort of parallels what David Carter did, and the guy who wrote the book Stonewall. Because I was under the impression, before I read this book or really dove into it, he spent 10 years writing the book, that a lot of these people were no longer with us. There are a lot of myths in the story. And you still have some things you don't know about, but you really did dive into as much as you possibly could.
That is true. I tried to be real careful as I wrote this story, especially about the 50s or 60s, to say, I'm not sure about this, but
right.
the weight of the evidence. There were probably about 8 to 10 people from that period of time that I could count on the most. And there was one man I thought I could count on most of the time. And then when I finally realized at one point there were 6 women totally against him. I mean, as far as what had happened in a certain year. He was absolutely sure there wasn't a Diana party at Tom Adams' apartment. And all 6 of them were absolutely positive. Mm. So you have to,
well,
you have to make
was,
a judgment call.
You know, at the recent Arch meeting, they said that. I mean, you could just think that, well, one of the examples was they have a picture with a date on the back. Somebody could have wrote the wrong date on it just because that number's on there. And this is not necessarily somebody doing something wrong. It's just your memory is not always what you think it is.
Yes, you need substantiation and resubstantiation on all these things.
And I would bet there was nothing like in the newspapers at the time, was there?
Yeah, how did they get the word out back then? Was it just word of mouth? Or
there was
no Facebook?
We did have help from the newspapers.
No, I think you meant about how did gay people get information.
Well, how did people that aren't in the know find out about the Dianas, and how did they, you know, over the years bring new people in and continue for so long?
Well, I think
back in the Dark Ages.
I think we figured in about the late 50s, early 60s, there were probably about 150 to 200 people that were gay that went out to bars. There were gay bars. And there was a straight one called Rudy's that was on Main Street that knew people were gay, but if they didn't flaunt it, they were okay. So these people partied, they cross-partied.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they found out about the Dianas. But the Dianas really got to be the event of the year that people wanted to get the ticket to. And
how did they get the ticket?
It was usually, part of it was actually being a part of helping produce it, because Charles Hebert, who started it, really loved to use technology. And he put a lot of time into the writing of it. They used to give out 14 awards. Now they give out 4. And they always kept them very closely aligned to the actual Academy Awards. And then they used to actually watch the Academy Awards after they did it. They stopped that about 73. The programs just got so big.
Right. And there's sort of a parallel here with Miss Camp America. Although Miss Camp America came much, much later.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine that first time that television, the screen must have been so small and, you know, black and white, poor reception.
Did they even have TV when this first started? I guess not.
Well, the first year in 1953 is when the Oscars were first televised.
Right.
And that was actually that first year David Moncrief, who actually was the founder of the group, had a party and bought a TV just for this. And then he turned it on, and you know, like back in those days, how you played the rabbit ears?
Right.
No reception. They couldn't get it. But the next year, they came back, and that was actually the first Diana party. So that year the TV did work.
They said, we're going to parallel the Academy Awards. We're going to give our own Academy Awards. And they made up movie names that were similar to the movie names that had won or that were, and contrived to make events that had happened to Diana members similar to the plots in the movies. I'm not sure how many of these we can say on the air because
right.
They were risque and they had a heck of a lot of fun doing
still it. After all these years.
Yeah.
And it was a dress-up event, right?
Oh, yeah.
It got to be a really dress-up. Well, back then in the 50s, people just dressed up to go to a cocktail party. Actually, back in the 50s, people drank a lot.
Charles's dogs dressed up, right?
That's right.
Yeah, they bow ties and...
I'm sort of thinking of the TV series Mad Men, how they drank a lot, they dressed
show.
Up a lot. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very authentic show. That's what's impressive about that.
The women didn't go anywhere without their pearls and pumps, you know, and so even the lesbians. Although one of the cutest things they told me was that one of their favorite parties was what they called dollar dinner night. They would have like 12 people, and they would get invited to somebody's house, and they would each pay a dollar to get in. But then the host had to give them dinner for $12. He had to put the, or she had
wow.
to figure out how to take $12 and be clever enough to put it together to make a meal. So, you know, before TV and Facebook and the internet and all that, gay people found a lot of ways to amuse themselves. And let's face it, you know, gay people are clever and creative, and so... These were clever, creative people.
I wanted to ask the question. In your research, have you found the secret to the longevity? What has kept the Dianas around and relevant and kept them going for so long? Because there's so many organizations that just die on the vine, literally wither.
I really was very curious about that because two things. One, I thought, why the Dianas? Why not some political organization?
Exactly.
And second, why not New York or San Francisco? And what people... when I discussed it with people, they said, first of all, probably because of the fact it wasn't political is why it lasted for 57 years. And second, because it wasn't in an epicenter is why it lasted. Because in epicenters, you have a lot of activity, but they're very transitional. People come and go quickly. Whereas here in Houston, a lot of these people had been born here, raised here, gone to school.
Right. So, it wasn't such a magnet back then as it is, you know, in the 80s and so bringing people in.
Mm-hmm.
Were there some of the people, were they their long, you know, 10 years in some of the people that were involved?
Mm-hmm. Charles Hebert really was the driving force behind it. And that went from 54 to 87. He was murdered in 1987. You may remember that.
Yeah.
He had a townhouse on Mason Street. And
Mason,
not very far from, right around the corner from where Numbers is.
Really?
Maybe two or three blocks from there.
Yes, I know that area well. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So as you're doing the research on this story, were there other things you sort of uncovered that you may want to use in some other stories?
I did uncover a lot of things. It was really difficult even to get it down to 30,000 words, which, you know...
It's incredible, yeah.
Greg Jew just turned white when I... Imagine. And he was very brave to do this.
Right.
He actually had to hire four editors to edit this down to 10,000 words, 5,000 in each issue. And even that's like twice as much as he would ever give a feature story.
Now, the archives, the Charles Botts archives and GCAM, which you were a part of GCAM, right? That helped you in the research?
Actually, it was the Botts Museum that had a real breakthrough there. I had gone out there to talk to them about something. Oh, they had a game of Gay Monopoly. Somebody told me there was a Diana card in there. And sure enough, they had a copy of Gay Monopoly, and sure enough, there's a Diana card. And while I was there, Larry Crisseron said, let me check our files, because he's really done a good job there. It's all very indexed.
Yeah.
And he said, we'll see if we have a Diana file. I said, you probably won't. And about 10 minutes later, he walked back with this folder about that thick. And I opened it up and just gasped, because it was Diana stuff way back to 1965.
Wow.
Was it like
pictures and articles and stuff?
It was all of the scripts that they'd used for each show.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
And I think probably from the looks of it, I think it was Charles Hebert's file. And I'm just going to guess that Charles Botts was smart enough back then to get his hands on that thing after Charles was murdered.
Wow.
Because everything else has disappeared. I mean, what would break your heart is that they used to take 16mm movies of these things.
Oh, imagine if we could get a hold of those.
They're gone. Last anybody knew, they were in somebody's attic.
So if you're out there and you have the movies from the old Diana's productions, our community could use. I mean, that's a piece of history that's out there.
We do have a bunch of videos.
Yes.
But videos starting
very, very early. They're, what year?
78. 77.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can go on Facebook and see them doing the can-can.
let's give a plug for the Facebook. Is it Diana?
Uh-huh.
Foundation?
It's
or
called, right.
It's called the Diana Foundation.
It's got a Z in front of it. The Diana Foundation, and so. It's got a lot of pictures and a few videos, and it's going to have more videos, is it?
Mm-hmm.
And the Diana's today. I mean, not everybody goes to the event. How is the organization doing today?
The organization has about 70 members, and it seems to be growing again. It's totally evolved over the years, so that's what I was fascinated with, too, that it's always been continually changing. Some people have their favorite era, and they think, oh, the real Dianas were back in the tower. But then there are people who think the real Dianas was when they were in homes,
right,
and everybody knew each other. And the people nowadays who've joined didn't even have a clue about any of the other stuff. So they think the Dianas today are what the Dianas are. But the Dianas is really all those things. And I think the important thing is they've survived.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that we've got this one link back to those bad days.
When did they become a nonprofit organization?
That was in 76.
Wow.
It was basically because the people that were putting together the shows did it all out of their own pocketbooks.
Yeah.
And finally Charles Hebert said, look, let's make this a 501c3. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we can, the money, it would be easier, they could give money to it and then
get the tax benefit.
Yeah,
I also understand, like, in the 60s and probably early 70s, it was really difficult to become a gay nonprofit. And that's why a lot of those are probably don't even have the GLBT word in it.
Well, I know.
Human rights or, you know. That's my understanding. I could be wrong.
No, that is right. In fact, I wondered where Daughters of Bilitis came from, and I checked that out on Wikipedia. And the woman that wrote it said it could have been a garden club. She
right.
purposely wrote it.
Vaguely enough,
so
for the IRS.
And everything back then was a daughter, Daughters of the Confederacy,
right.
Daughters of the America. So they decided to call it the Daughters of Bilitis, and nobody ever got it.
Well, and I think the Diana Foundation, the name itself kind of could allude to some Greek organization, some, you know, kind of back to that, you know, it kind of is.
It had a good reason for
actually,
being called
Diana. Actually, Diana was Roman.
I apologize to
the right.
Well,
so what was the origin of the name?
David Moncrief's partner, I don't know whether he was just his roommate or his partner, to tell you the truth, but anyway, he was a window dresser at Sekowitz, and they had a big statue of what they thought was Diana, which was probably Athena or someone like that.
No, actually, the statue was Diana.
It was with the bow and arrow. Oh. And anyway, when they didn't need it anymore, it was not stone. It was something else. It was made of plaster or something. He brought it home, and David Moncrief had it in his dining room. And when they had parties, they would put lays on it and decorate it with whatever the season's thing was. And that's where they got the name from, is they had this thing that they said, well, we have Diana standing in the corner here. And we're going
wow.
to give you the first award from the Diana Party.
Amazing.
During one of those, Academy Award affairs.
Well, this is just an absolutely wonderful story, and I really appreciate you sharing this with not only us, but the community at large, and the fact that it's online. And Greg allowed you to do this, even though you probably, he's probably sorry in some senses that he did allow you all to do it.
I think you should get a lot of credit for being brave enough.
Well,
we love Greg. Thank
and
you.
And you all for putting all the time and effort into this. This is absolutely wonderful to have this history recreated for us so that we would know about it. So what's next?
Next, I have a life again. I will admit, though, this story, it was a bit like Alice in Wonderland falling into a rabbit hole. Just when I thought I was done, you know, I'd see something ducking around the corner, and I just had to pursue it, because these people were characters.
Yeah.
If you'd gotten into it as deeply as we got to know them, they're just some incredibly colorful people.
And I think this is kind of becoming a lost history on the kind of the younger generation that don't know anything about the Diana Foundation and what was it like before, you know, Stonewall, when we had the bar culture? I mean, what did people do? I think it's very important that we're broadcasting this history for people.
Actually, what's next is Brandon hasn't finished putting up the whole second section of the Facebook coverage for the last 30 years of the Dianas. So, and that's where there's a huge amount of material because it's more recent and it was easier to find.
Right.
I collected so many documents and pictures. I didn't just want to keep them to myself, so I thought I'd put them out there and share them.
Well, fabulous. So what's the Facebook page?
It's just called the Diana Foundation.
And you can see the article at outsmartmagazine.com. Brandon Wolfe and Chris Dolby, thank you very much for joining us tonight, and thank you for all your work in preserving this history.
Thank you, Jack.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
I'm Linda Birch.
And I'm Ben Caron.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending March 27, 2010. Indonesian police ordered the cancellation this week of the Asian Regional Conference of the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association, known by the shorter acronym ILGA. Organizers of the local host group, Gaya Nusantara, in Surabaya, East Java's capital, said they had expected more than 150 activists from about 100 organizations in 16 Asian countries to attend the three-day conference. Police officials said that an influential board of Muslim clerics warned of violent protests and demanded the cancellation. There are indications that the unrest could trigger a social crisis and cause public unrest, a national police spokesman told reporters. A spokesman for the clerical council said that lesbians and gays are contrary to Islamic teaching. We will continue to reject any kind of homosexual event. ILGA is a worldwide federation of more than 560 local, national, and international organizations. An ILGA press release reported that a crowd of Muslim fundamentalists entered the reception area of the hotel hosting many of the conference delegates late this week, demanding that they be evicted. They are all safe, the release continued. They are being evacuated and are presently being transferred to safe places. Regional ILGA Asia conferences have been held in recent years without trouble in India, the Philippines, and Thailand.
Updating stories we've been following in Africa, there was no verdict in Malawi this week as previously predicted in the trial of Stephen Monjeza and Tuwange Chimbalanga. They're a gay couple charged with unnatural offenses and indecent practices between males for holding a public engagement party in December. They've twice been denied bail, and if convicted, face up to 14 years in prison. The defense was initially not allowed to present its case, and the judge had previously said that a verdict would be announced on March 22nd. He instead issued a decision that day ordering a full trial, scheduled to begin on April 6th. The case has made headlines across the country, prompting a three-day meeting of the Malawi Council of Churches earlier this month. That's the country's main Protestant group, which labeled homosexuality sinful and condemned what it called threats by some Western countries to withdraw financial aid to force Malawi to accept homosexuality.
International pressure continues against the government of Uganda over its proposed Anti-Homosexuality Act, which includes the death penalty for some cases of private consensual adult homosexual acts. The measure would also jail anyone who fails to report a suspected gay or lesbian person to the authorities. Canada's House of Commons passed a resolution this week urging their government to speak out against the legislation. A statement issued by the Australian delegation at a meeting of the United Nations Human Rights Council, joined by Canada and New Zealand, said that Sexual orientation or gender identity must never be the basis for discrimination, abuse, criminal action and penalties, detention or imprisonment, or deprivation of any human right. And the South African Broadcasting Corporation reported this week that Ugandan lesbian and gay activists are calling on South African President Jacob Zuma to use his two-day state visit to their country to persuade his counterpart, Yoweri Museveni, to see that the bill is withdrawn from Parliament, something the Ugandan president has said he can't legally do. Zuma is leading a high-level business delegation to Uganda with the stated mission of exploring further trade and investment opportunities. It's unlikely that either leader will publicly comment on the Anti-Homosexuality Act during Zuma's visit.
And making headlines, but not much real news this week, Zimbabwe Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai said at a public event with President Robert Mugabe that rights for sexual minorities should not be included in a new constitution. Mugabe called the idea madness, insanity. He's notoriously described gays and lesbians as worse than pigs and dogs. Tsvangirai said he agreed with the president's position. Why should a man seek to have a relationship with another man, he asked, when women make up 52% of the population? A new constitution is supposed to be drafted this year to pave the way for new elections in Zimbabwe after disputed results in 2008 led to the creation of a so-called unity government between former rivals Mugabe and Tsvangirai. But there's reportedly been little progress made on the draft since that process began last year.
Elsewhere, the leader of Australia's opposition Liberal Party, Tony Abbott, voiced his support for stronger non-discrimination laws during an interview with LGBT Melbourne radio station Joy FM this week. It was apparently an effort to counter comments he made in a national television interview last week where he said he sometimes felt a bit threatened by homosexuality. He told Joy FM that his comments were a poor choice of words. Abbott said he was also very happy to look at civil unions, but reaffirmed his opposition to marriage equality. I'm in favor of stable enduring relationships, he said. But Australian marriage equality spokesman Alex Greenwich asked in a statement, why does Tony Abbott want to invent an entirely new federal scheme for recognizing and fostering stable enduring relationships when we already have one called marriage? And retired openly gay Senator Brian Gregg noted that Prime Minister Kevin Rudd's ruling Labor Party had dragged its feet on the same issues, referring to Australia's United Nations statement about Uganda's Anti-Homosexuality Act, Gregg wrote that it didn't apply in his own country. The federal government continues to justify the absence of any national laws against sexuality discrimination, he said, and continues to deny same-sex couples access to equal marriage, which it does not regard as a human right.
The debate on health care reform in the United States, which was filled with ugly name-calling and outright lies by corporate-backed so-called Tea Party conservatives, hit a new low this week as the bill headed toward passage. Demonstrators at an opposition rally yelled the N-word at members of the Congressional Black Caucus as they entered the Capitol building to vote on the measure. One of the congressmen, Democrat Emmanuel Cleaver of Missouri, was spat upon by a protester. And openly gay Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts was called a faggot in what the Huffington Post described as deliberately lispy screams. The minority Republican Party strategy to delay passage of the health care reform measure included the introduction of several amendments in the Senate. One of them, offered by Utah's Robert Bennett, would have stripped the District of Columbia of its recently enacted marriage equality law and forced a public referendum on the issue. It was defeated by a mostly party-line vote of 59-36.
Senior proms also continue to make U.S. news. Derek Martin, an 18-year-old honor student at Bleckley County High School in Cochrane, Georgia, was given the okay this week to bring his boyfriend to the prom. But his parents, upset by the subsequent media attention, kicked him out of their home. According to Macon's Telegraph newspaper, Martin is staying with a friend. He said he was inspired by another Southern teenager, Constance McMillan, who was denied permission to bring her girlfriend to senior prom in Fulton, Mississippi. The American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit on her behalf against the school district. A federal judge ruled this week that while the Itawamba Agricultural High School violated McMillan's rights, it would not have to hold the prom, which school officials had already canceled. Martin's prom is scheduled for April 17th.
During his testimony last month to a U.S. congressional committee about repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the Pentagon policy banning military service by open gays and lesbians, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said that planning for the implementation of repeal would take his department until the end of the year. Repealing the policy, passed in 1993 and signed by President Bill Clinton, requires another act of Congress, most likely as part of a Defense Department spending bill, the same way the original policy was instituted. During his testimony, Gates also promised a quicker review to make changes to how the current policy is enforced. He announced those changes this week. New regulations raise the level of officers authorized to initiate Don't Ask, Don't Tell investigations and approve discharges to top command positions. They also limit discharge proceedings if a third party outed the service member. Lesbian and gay personnel who voluntarily come out are still subject to discharge. Gates told reporters that the new regulations apply to current investigations as well as to any future cases. While LGBT advocacy groups generally praised the move, one queer pundit said that the policy should now be called Now We Really, Really Won't Ask.
And finally, a new group in the Netherlands, Pink Army, whose members are gay former Dutch soldiers, said late last week that it intended to sue retired U.S. Marine General John Sheehan for slander and defamation. In testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee, Sheehan blamed a terrible massacre that occurred during the Bosnian War on open gays being allowed to serve in the Dutch military. He claimed to have been told by Dutch officials that the so-called social liberalization had weakened the country's armed forces. Several officials in the Netherlands, from military leaders to the country's prime minister, denied that anyone in the Dutch armed forces told Sheehan any such thing and variously condemned his assertions as disgraceful, outrageous, and beneath contempt. Pink Army founder Peter Schouten said that the general had smeared gay soldiers with lies. There are far too many people who might believe this nonsense, he said. A majority of politicians in the Dutch parliament voted this week to support Pink Army's initiative to secure an apology from General Sheehan through a federal class action lawsuit to be filed in California. The group wants to force him to publicly retract his statements and attend a sensitivity training course.
That's News Wrap for the week ending March 27, 2010. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. You can read the text of this week's News Wrap online at www.thiswayout.org. For This Way Out, I'm Linda Birch.
And I'm Ben Caron.
This is Queer Voices.
If you are gay and have lived in Houston for any period of time, you know that Easter is a big event, a big deal around here. And one of the major organizations, there's two that we're going to talk about, Bunnies on the Bayou, puts on a very large outdoor party on Easter Sunday. And in the studio tonight, we have Vince Flickinger.
Congratulations.
And Jack Berger. I was trying not to flub his last name. President, and Jack, you're the vice president of Bunnies on the Bayou.
Correct.
So if we have listeners that have never heard of Bunnies on the Bayou, what is Bunnies on the Bayou?
Bunnies on the Bayou is the largest outdoor cocktail party in the state of Texas. Possibly the world, but that's not official.
Well, by far most fabulous.
Yes, it's a wonderful event. People who have known each other for years or have never met anybody or new to town, old to town, been around, never been around, all of them can come out, have a great time, see their old friends, make new ones, have a blast. It's from 1 to 6 on Easter Sunday, every Easter. And it's a fabulous event. We have wonderful sponsors, wonderful beneficiaries, and wonderful hosts that all come together to put on a spectacularly fun event.
And sort of go to church.
Go to church early.
Come.
Yeah.
Let your hair down.
Mm-hmm.
Take off your clothes.
Yes.
Get comfortable in this. It's supposed to be beautiful weather this Sunday.
Yes, it's been shifting on us, but we've been guaranteed by the forces that be, namely some wonderful weather forecasters who have told us that there will be a little bit of rain.
Part of the community,
Saturday.
Are they?
Yes. And
can't throw a stone and not hit a gay weatherman in Houston.
or the planet. And they have told us we will have a sunny Sunday, and we could be getting close to 80, so it'll be nice and warm, and that makes for
And what does that equal, Vince?
Shirts off.
Oh my gosh.
Shirts on, shirts off.
And lots of tickets sold.
Lots of tickets sold, yes.
Now, yes, exactly. Now, did we say the exact location before?
It's 500 Texas Avenue in Fish Plaza in front of the Wortham Center, which is downtown Houston. If you know where... I'm not going to say that word because they don't sponsor us. If you know where Rock Bar Mosaic is,
there you go.
Or those downtown movie theaters.
Yeah, that were right there. And just listen for the music once you get there because you can find
it. No, it's more like listen for the thump.
Yeah. rabbit thump.
So this is which year are we in?
It's our 31st year, 32nd event. It gets a little crazy, but we go by year.
Yes.
The first event was not necessarily counted, so we go by years. And this year, we have an ice cream theme.
I love your theme.
And I brought an invitation. It says after 31
years.
Tell
us what it is.
After 31 years, we've got your flavor, bunnies. And it's certainly not vanilla. And then we have a whole list of 31 flavors, which we can go through a little bit. And also to go along with this, we have an Easter Sunday, Sundae.
Oh, so clever.
To go along with the ice cream
clever
thing.
Bunnies on the bunny.
And that slogan is, this party's hard to top. And, of course, the 31 is the cherry on top. So,
wink, wink,
yeah,
wink,
so,
wink.
So it's a play on ice cream. And it actually was one of the first ideas we came up with. And then we went through a whole bunch of others. And then, you know what? We like that one the best, and through Dwight Douthat with Douthat Design Group, they helped us fulfill it and come up with a bunch of ads and an invitation and all these little things.
It's very clever, and I love it, and I'm all about the graphics, and it's appropriate. And
I'll let y'all read some of the flavors if you'd like, because all of them are great. Some of them are better than others, but that's just depends
on
who you are.
The professional vocal stylings of Jennifer Renee.
Oh, really? Oh, hair. Raisin.
Yes.
Oh, yes. H-A-I-R. 24 carat crunch.
Oh. S&M, M&M.
Green tea dance.
that's
who you calling fruity?
Rainbow ribbon. Hip hop butterscotch. You go girl swirl.
Y'all spent a lot
of
time
on
this,
one.
I can tell.
Y'all had fun writing these.
Tricks.
These are good. Oh, yes.
Now, Let's talk
who
about
you calling fruity?
Let's talk about people that may have not attended Bunnies on the Body. What can they expect? What kind of people will they see typically?
Typically, and every year, it's a broad spectrum of people. Right, Jack?
The nice thing about this is groups of friends can come in packs. We may have some folks wearing drag. We may have folks that tie-dye or put purple
Easter
bonnets on, or food coloring on their poodles. Or, you know, we don't encourage pets to come, but obviously we want everyone to have a good time. And maybe just some normal folks that just come in a T-shirt and shorts and just come and have a few beverages with us and enjoy the sunshine. And, of course, the Flyboys will be back for yet another year.
Yes, the fabulous Flyboys.
They're
back.
Sort of our halftime entertainment. We've got two DJs this year, which is different for us. We have Joy De La O, who will kick it off, and then the Flyboys in between, and then DJ Tad, everyone's favorite DJ from Meteor, will be taking us home, if you will. And it's just a really fun party. I went for the first time 4 years ago, had such a good time, I joined as a host the very next year.
You went for the first time 4 years ago, Jack Berger?
Jack Berger.
Jack Berger, 4 years
ago. I wasn't gay then.
Ah.
He was giffy.
So if...
You were just testing the waters?
I was.
Now, do you have enough people helping you out with the event? Do you need volunteers? Or should we kind of appeal to the Queer Voices listeners? Or
I think we're right at our number, but I'm not sure. If you're still interested in volunteering, you can go to our website, www.bunniesonthebayou.org. Once you enter the website, there will be a flashing sign on your left-hand side that says volunteer. Click on that, fill it out, and we will respond to you. And once we hit our number, that flashing thing will probably disappear.
So advanced.
Yeah. Or we hope it'll disappear.
So how many people usually come, and what is your record?
Our record, I think, is a little over 2,000 people. It's been a while since we've done that. Last year felt like a record because nobody left.
I know. It was awesome.
Yeah. It ends at 6, and we didn't get everybody out until 6:30, so we were there for a while. But our record, I think, is a little over 2,000. It was set in the about 8 years ago, I believe. Yeah. We haven't had in a while. Even though the last 2 years felt like records, they weren't.
Well, that says a lot about it. You know, people staying and enjoying it right till the end. You know you're having a good time, and it's a great party.
Yeah, and it's really scary when you do the numbers and you think, okay, 1,800 people, but how did we go through 360 bottles of vodka? Because if you do the math,
them girls can drink.
Yeah, we
that
ordered,
just shouldn't work.
We ordered 30% more liquor last year than we normally do. We ran out 3 hours in.
Wow.
We ran out of vodka 3 hours
in. And that's the first rule of a gay party, never run out of vodka.
Oh, but our store is right across the street because we actually purchase our liquor from our favorite after-hour party place, and that's Rock Bar Mosaic. So thankfully for them, they helped us out.
Yeah, and we never run out of Bud Light because there aren't. Our key sponsor.
Yes.
Now, a couple years ago, you added this thing called Camp Bunny. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Camp Bunny basically is a series of 10 by 20 tents that can be purchased by either individuals or corporations that want to come out and have a little bit more of a VIP experience, but also sort of a see and be seen opportunity and show off. They're themed. Everyone is encouraged to really decorate their tent. It could be a play on the Playboy bunnies or whatever. They keep getting better every
it's
year.
Very creative and very competitive because everybody's kind of like competing to get people to come to their tent. So.
Right. And they have a private bartender. Last year we added the private porta potty for VIPers. But it's a great opportunity for groups of friends, like I said, or organizations or companies to, you know, really set themselves apart from the rest.
Now, let's get serious for a second. This is a fundraiser for the community. Let's talk about what the money goes towards.
Every October, we have a request for proposals, and the charities committee then takes a look at what we have, and we try to narrow it down. This year, we had over 20 different organizations apply for funding.
Yeah, I think we were close to 30. It was a tremendous.
Is that good response. Or bad? Because
for us, that's good. Normally, we're probably in the around 20 range, and so we had more than what was typical.
Right.
And we had a lot of new ones as well. Mm-hmm. So it was good to see the responses. There's some that we're going to go back and talk to because we would like them to reapply next year and tell them, you know, explain to them why or not you're selected. It's a difficult process, but we have to whittle it down. And we whittled it down to 12, which was a little.
And we have some old favorites who've been have gotten money in the past, and we've got some new folks.
Well, let's go through the list. Let's
okay.
Who do we have this year?
This year we have AIDS Foundation Houston, Bayou City Performing Arts, Bearing Omega Community Services, Center for AIDS, Colt 45s, ICOH, Lazarus House, Lesbian Health Initiative, Montrose Counseling Center, the Osito Foundation, Pet Patrol, and, of course, PFLAG. So,
you know, and listening to that, it's a very diverse list, and I guess you put effort into kind of getting all facets of the community and trying to reach
spectrum.
Out there.
Yeah, so I mean, we have a very, very short list of requirements when people put their request for proposal in. There are certain things we don't fund, whether it's, you know, employment situations. You know, we don't do people. We want to do programs, and when those folks who write the grants get that under control, it makes it relatively simple to apply for Bunny's funding.
Now, do you follow up with the organizations after you give them money and make sure that they're
That's part of the process. It's a 6-month reporting that they have to do and let us know where our monies went.
Very good. Now, we can't talk about ticket prices per se, but let's talk about where one can get tickets.
You can either go to www.bunniesonthebayou.org, and you can purchase the tickets online, or you can go to M10 Fashion or PJ's Fashion for the Modern Man, and both of them are selling tickets for us this year.
Now, is it too late to get the VIP tickets?
No,
never.
Never too late. VIP tickets are on sale right now all the way up into the event and during the event.
And let's talk about the perks for those.
The VIP gets a private restroom area, so they don't have to. There's a
which is
line.
A huge deal.
That's worth it. on a warm Sunday afternoon.
Drinking beer,
it is ideal because the lines can get a little long. We even ordered additional porta potties.
So yeah, I'm clapping for that.
But no matter how many we order, they always fill up. So you also get premium vodka, liquor, and all the other good stuff. And you get to stand by the DJ and stand up in the gazebo and look down on everybody.
And you can like, look along upon the masses. Yes. And say, hello.
And so, I mean, those are the biggest reasons. You can also kind of get away. It's usually a little less crowded in that area.
And plus a bigger tax deduction.
Yes.
And more money to the beneficiary.
Absolutely.
Exactly. So we always encourage everybody to become a VIP. But if not, advanced ticket sales, can we give the amount? No?
Mm-hmm. No. We're a nonprofit and we can't.
Are very inexpensive. And yes. If you buy them in advance, they're cheaper than what they are at the gates.
Considering what you get, it's whatever. It's a good price.
Oh, it is well worth the money. Even okay. Buying a VIP ticket, you are probably getting more than what you Absolutely. Would if you were going out to a bar.
Well, it's a challenge to get your money. You're like, I'm going to get my money.
And bring some tipping money in case you like the bartender.
Okay. Yes, because all the tips go to charity as well.
So give us the time and the information again. One more time.
It's Easter Sunday, April 4th.
That's this coming Sunday.
It's coming Sunday from 1 to 6. We have DJ Jessica, Joy De La O and DJ Tad. And the Flyboys.
And we have some really exciting news. For the first time ever, food at Bunny's.
Yes. I heard that.
Yes, this is good.
We are doing
a test run. Who eats food? No, I'm just kidding.
I do. I eat all the time. We're doing a test run for having food this year. So Chili's has come and offered to assist us and just seen how it goes. And for a very small amount, which we think is a great value, you can get a hamburger, cheeseburger, chicken sandwich, and a bag of chips. So all that and a bag of chips.
Right. are they going to cook them on site, or are they just going to haul them over?
They're going to cook at their Taylor Street location and bring them over as needed. So they're not going to come all at once. They're going to kind of feed us as needed.
Very good. Yes, nice. You're changing it up.
Yes, and most of the money, they're covering their cost, and they're even covering their labor, and all the money's going to charity for that as well.
Okay, so if you are one of the listeners out there that have not been to Bunny's on the Bayou, let me tell you, I've been many, many years, and you are missing out. Definitely make plans for Sunday, 1 to 6, Warden Plaza, Fish Plaza. The website is?
www.bunniesonthebayou.org. You can also find us on Facebook under Bunny's on the Bayou.
All right. Do you have anything else you want our listeners to know?
We also have an after party across the street, Rockmart Mosaic. It starts at 5 o'clock, and we have two DJs as well. There's going to be DJ Jessica Lozano and then DJ Mohawk Steve, and they're going to be spinning at Mosaic, one spinning at Rock Bar, and all you need to get in is your wristband that you paid for when you came into Bunny's. So it's
just
free entry.
A long price.
Well, it is.
Sounds good.
Well, Vince and Jacques, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you guys for having us.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Jennifer.
We'll see you Sunday, and this is Queer Voices.
Science of Spirituality Houston Branch is conducting free meditation classes on the physical, mental, and spiritual benefits of meditation. This is a two-part series held the last two Sundays of every month from April to July. Part one covers the basics of meditation, stilling the body, calming the mind, and learning to focus. Part two covers advanced meditation techniques and how to get the most out of your meditation. The classes are from noon to 1:30 p.m. in room 213 of Robertson Hall at the University of St. Thomas, 3800 Montrose Boulevard, Houston, Texas. For more information, visit HoustonSOS.org. This has been KPFT Houston, 90.1 on your dial. The Alliance for Multicultural Community Services will be hosting their annual Stars Among Us Gala, April 3rd, honoring immigrants who have made significant contributions to improve the quality of life of people around them. This year, the Alliance will honor Dr. Nidil Najam, a Pakistani immigrant and Nobel Prize laureate, for his work on climate change, and Mr. Ahmad Al-Yassin of Jordan, a leader in Houston's Arab American community. Proceeds from the Stars Among Us event fund scholarships for refugee youth resettled by the agency. Individual tickets are $100, or a group can sponsor a table. For more information and to buy tickets, go to www.allianceontheweb.org and click Stars Among Us. This is KPFT Houston.
Shoulder to the Stone is both a song and the title of a compilation CD to be used to fund an orphanage and a Haitian humanitarian worker who lost his home and family with the exception of a brother. The project was created by a coalition of artists, songwriters, and musicians. 18 singer-songwriters performed on the recording of this song. The CD release will be April 3rd, 2010 at J.P. Hop's house at 8 p.m. The performance will be filmed and recorded for a possible documentary. This is KPFT, Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
topsy-turvy. That was the Great Peace March by the Bayou City Chorale.
Well, what a coincidence. With us here are two board members from the Bayou City Performing Arts Organization, which is both men and women. Jim Fox and Sid White are here. They are both on the board. And, Jim, why don't you tell us a little bit about the organization?
Sure. For those who aren't familiar with Bayou City Performing Arts, they may be familiar with the name the Montrose Singers. That's the name that the organization was founded under back in 1979. In 92, the men of the men's chorus, the Montrose Singers, decided we need to be a little more out there in the community and not be ashamed of who we are, and that led to the renaming of the organization as the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston. In the early 2000s, we saw there was a great desire of the women in the community, both straight and lesbian, to form a women's chorus. So we created the Bayou City Performing Arts moniker as the umbrella for all of our choruses and formed the Bayou City Women's Chorus in 2005. And in 2007, we debuted the Bayou City Chorale, which is the men and women's combined group. And we debuted them performing a benefit concert for the Susan G. Komen Foundation, performing the Sing for the Cure, which was a fantastic success for us. So it's our 31st season. It's also the first season under our new artistic director, Dr. Linus Lerner, who came to us from his previous post in Arizona, in Tucson. And Linus has just done a wonderful job of reconnecting the organization with old friends that we had kind of lost touch with in the community. One great example is Marion Coleman and Kindred Spirits, and we're partnering with them in our June concert, which will be kind of a naughty concert, if you will, a little bit of a different take. It's called Let's Misbehave. So there's some real satire, obviously, that name implies. And Kate Clinton is going to be our guest host for that concert.
That's fabulous. The course has really come a long way from performing into smaller auditoriums wherever you can find space to be performing in the major auditoriums downtown. That's a giant step.
And that was, I think that's part of the legacy of James Knapp, who was our artistic director for 8 years and through this past season. It was his dream to be able to perform in some of the major downtown venues, and it was a very proud moment when we performed for the first time in Jones Hall to a crowd of nearly 2,000 people for our holiday concert back about 5 years ago. And that continues to be the home for the men, and when the men and women perform together, they also perform at Jones Hall. The women perform out in West Houston at Unity Church, who have been a very gracious host for us and provide a home for the women. So we're just very, very proud. It's the irony, even though there's so much excitement that we've seen this year with the organization, with Linus's arrival and feedback we've gotten from the concerts we've had to date, is that like all not-for-profit organizations, we are really struggling to survive.
Sure, sure.
And so that's part of the reason why we're here tonight, is to talk about our upcoming auction event.
Yes, you've got an event coming up at the Alley.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what is it? What is it? It's the fourth annual one, isn't it?
It's called Just an Auction. We used to do a black tie like every other organization did, and we got the word that, you know, people were tired of having to put on the suits and the gowns and whatnot. So we scaled it back to basically just an auction, mm-hmm. a silent live auction. And yes, this is the fourth year, the third year we've had at the Alley. It's a great venue for we have in the long lobby, which is just a wonderful space. And Sid is here with me this evening to talk a little bit more about what we have to offer. We think some really exciting things that hopefully people will be interested to come see and bid on.
What do we have? When we walk in there, what do we expect to see?
Well, this year we've expanded our catalog of items considerably from previous years. We have items that range in value from $25 all the way up to $2,500. So we have things for just about everybody. There's lots of art, jewelry, vacation packages, spa packages, wine, restaurants, entertainment. We've got some of the notable items we have is a weekend in Santa Fe. We have a Lucky Strike, the new bowling alley downtown at Houston Pavilions, is providing a private party for up to 8 people. Meteor is graciously given us a VIP birthday party for 25 to 250 people, which we think is a pretty great event. We've had lots of businesses around town that have graciously donated items and services to us, and we're packaging things and trying to create some really memorable type experiences for people to bid on.
So when you come to this auction, is it mm-hmm. going to be a silent auction or a live auction?
It's actually both. We have a silent auction, and then we'll also have a live auction, which I believe we're going to have 6 or 7 items in that. One of those is a trip to Boston and Provincetown. We've got...
I believe a trip to Cancun.
We have a trip to Cancun. We have a private dinner party that we've arranged for a professional chef to come and prepare dinner. And we also have the women's chorus is going to put themselves up as a live auction item this year, and they will come and perform at your event for a private performance.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. So that's it. And they will also be performing at the event as well. So if you want a sampling of the great talent in our choruses, this will be a great opportunity to come.
Well, we've heard where it is mm-hmm. and what's going to be there, but when is it going to be?
It is going to be on April 1st, April Fool's Day, and it's not a joke.
You're not funning us, huh?
It's not a joke.
We show up and you're not going to be there,
no,
right?
No, we will be okay. there. We will be right. there at the Alley Theater at 6 o'clock. Until approximately 9 o'clock, I believe. Ernie Manouse is going to host our live auction again this year.
Good.
So we'll have complimentary wine, beer, sodas, or hors d'oeuvres will be passed. We'll also have a cash bar for those that want something a little bit stronger. That will also be available. One other unique item we have this year is... it's a type of raffle we're calling the Golden Ticket. And Baring & James Gallery has graciously donated 3 paintings, each valued at over $2,000. And the Golden Tickets, we're only selling 100 of them, and they cost $50 a ticket. And this is your opportunity to, if you are chosen as the having the winning ticket, to select one of these great pieces of art for your home.
We're really appreciative of Baring & James donating mm-hmm. 3 pieces of art. We went to them initially saying, could you give us three pieces of artwork that we could have on display, and we'll draw one winner and they can choose from the 3. And Austin James from Baring & James said, no, I'll give you all 3. And so we're going to have 3 winners.
We're going to have 3
drawings. Drawn, and for some just really fabulous
original. That's incredible.
Art. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You talked a little bit about the challenges that everybody's going through at these economic times, and doing this auction is one way that you're trying to meet the challenge. But I just could imagine to do the perfection that you're all trying to strive for in the courses, that it just must take an awful lot of money to be able to do that.
It does. It might be a little bit surprising what it takes to operate an organization, but. You know, Linus is a professional who has a master's in choral conducting and a PhD in orchestral conducting. He still conducts an orchestra in Tucson. And, you know, to have great talent like that, it costs money. To be able to perform in Jones Hall, it costs money. And we're trying to reach out beyond the traditional community, which is obviously always been very important to us, and through our programming and through venues, try and, you know, be more welcoming, if you will, to folks outside of the traditional LGBT community to come see our one of our fine courses, and universally, whenever someone from the mainstream community comes and sees the Gay Men's Chorus, disregarding whatever belief, stereotype they may have had before the concert. They all leave the concert equally moved, and many of them come back as subscribers for the full season or to attend single concerts. We have, I mentioned the National Anthem. We also performing with the Houston Pops in September. I mean, that's a huge thing for us to be in Jones Hall, not playing to a the typical, you know, predominantly gay and lesbian audience, but to the Houston Symphony.
Is the members made up of more older people or younger people?
We really have a great diversity.
Really?
And Linus is one thing that he's done, which James did as well, but he's really put a lot of focus on working with members to develop their choral skills. So, you know, we promote excellence in choral singing and also provide some community for the members. And so we have members ranging from, I think our youngest is 18, and our oldest is probably eligible for Social Security, I guess.
That'd be one way of putting it. Yep. My question is, do you have to be a professional? Do you have to be that qualified?
No.
I mean, you know, and you've gotten into these big venues, which, you know, you might start thinking out there, well, I could not that good. How would I compete with the people that are there? But that's not the case.
Right. That's a tradition of the organization. We don't force prospective members to go through a rehearsal or an audition. It's not like, you know, back in the days in elementary school or whatnot, where, you know, you'd be the last one to be picked for the team or not picked at all. You don't to lay the fear of, like, I'm not going to be good enough to be accepted. You have to have a pretty bad tune, if you will, to not be someone that we can work with. And Lita spends an incredible amount of time developing vocal skills, and so there's we do a voice placement, so he knows for the women whether they're sopranos or altos, the men whether they're tenor ones, tenor twos, upper lower baritones or upper lower basses, to place them from a range perspective. But it's incredible what we do with some are professionally trained, but most are not, we've gotten tremendous feedback. The Komen concert in 2007, the Chronicle reviewer, the arts reviewer, wrote just what we thought was just a wonderful review about our performance. And he kind of referred to us as a community chorus, but we said, you know, obviously the caliber of performance and the review that it warranted, we thought spoke volumes about what we've done with volunteer members who devote hundreds of hours over the course of the year.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, and that's important for them to know that when you hear about this or you hear about the concerts, and that if you can sing out there, you still have a place there in the chorus, or one of them. And I noticed that you have one that's called the Rhythms. What is that?
The Biorhythms is an ensemble group, mixed men and women, it's currently comprised of 12, six men and six women, and they've performed at the Gala Choruses Festival. It's held every 4 years. It was last held in Miami in 2008. They performed and got a standing ovation. We also try and use the small ensembles to promote the organization, to perform at various events, whether it's a corporate sponsor or a foundation or another non-for-profit that's having an event. We offer free of charge for our friends in the community, the opportunity to have one of our choruses or an ensemble of the chorus come and perform for them at their event, because it's a win-win for everyone. It provides some entertainment for whatever the event may be, but it also helps promote our organization and hopefully spread the word a little bit that much more.
Has the series Glee done anything for the chorus?
No comment.
No comment.
No comment.
We want to thank our guests, Sid White and Jim Fox, from the Bayou City Performing Arts. And the event is April 1st, a Thursday, at the Alley downtown, 6 p.m. And you have a Pride concert coming up, too, also.
Right. And for more information or to buy tickets for the auction event or for one of our concerts, go to our website, bcpahouston.org. There is an admission charge to the auction. It's $35 in advance, $50 at the door. So go on the website tonight, tomorrow, anytime before Thursday at 6 o'clock and put in your order, and you'll get a little bit of a break there. But it's a great event with, as Sid mentioned, open wine and beer bar and entertainment hors d'oeuvres and whatnot. And so...
And be sure to bring your checkbook or your credit card.
Yes. We'll accept cash.
Okay. All right.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
Again, from the album Topsy Turvy from 2009. That was the Bayou City Women's Chorus and the title of the song Ordinary Miracles. This is Queer Voices.
Well, we're going to be talking about movies right now, and Rob Aros is sort of going against the wave, I guess, a little bit, but that's good sometimes. Rob worked for Landmark Theaters for a while, right?
About 8 years.
Yeah, 8 years, and you were still helping them out on the side.
Yeah, for about a few years after that, actually. So collectively, about 10 years, I worked for Landmark Theaters.
And what is your love for movies? How did that come about?
It all started because the TV was a constant babysitter for me growing up. My mom was a single mom and working three jobs. She just sat me in front of the TV for most of my childhood. So,
and did you end up watching a lot of movies or series? Or just
it was a lot more movies than TV shows. Like TV shows, I guess I didn't have the patience for because I didn't understand what was going on. But with movies, I watched a lot of movies. And we moved around every few years, but we always end up being next to a video store somehow. So it was always relatively close, and my mom just talked to them and say, let him rent whatever he wants. And
what is your interest in movies? It, to me, it's like, I always learn something about that. It's sort of an education.
For me, it's just the process all around. I love, and making a movie is not easy. I mean,
exactly.
It sometimes it can be just a train wreck putting a movie together, and sometimes we end up watching those train wrecks. But
well, and it's interesting because we were one of the early people to get HBO way back up in northeastern Pennsylvania where it started, and one of the they used to play like one movie forever. I guess they still do that. But one
they
of them
do.
Was called
they make quality team.
Day for Night, which is a French movie about making a movie. And I just loved it because, and Jennifer probably relates to this too somewhat, is that these people came from all these different wherever, you know, and they were all together for like 6 weeks or 2 months or something like that, became a family, did the movie, and then they all left and went somewhere else.
Absolutely, that's the way it is.
I'm going to have to write that title. I haven't heard of that movie, but HBO produces a lot of good films.
Yes, well, this was a Truffaut movie.
Oh, okay.
So I'm getting way off the subject here. and the fact that you work for Landmark, there were the independent films.
That working for Landmark, I mean, prior to working for Landmark, my only access to films was like Blockbuster and the mainstream cinema. When I started working there in 99, imagine 10 years of film, watching
yes.
everything that opened there from the Greenway and the River Oaks. I mean, my mind was blown. I mean, I instantly fell in love with films.
And a whole new industry has developed in the filmmaking business that you go direct to video.
Yeah, there's a lot of... I mean, there's always been this direct-to-DVD market, but mm-hmm. now it's been more aggressive from the distributor point of view. For me, like, from my video store point of view, I don't carry a lot of straight-to-DVD, but there are certain distributors that do release their films simultaneously in theaters and on DVD.
Right.
Which I bank on those. Those are the smaller films. The whole point of that is, so smaller markets, not like Houston,
right.
where, you know, if you're it's not going to play in your local movie theater, but you can at least get it on DVD. It's to give more exposure to these smaller films.
Well, and I sort of wonder, though, I mean, Houston being the fourth largest city and like the, I don't know how many, the market size may be like ninth or tenth largest, you know, market size. Are we still a little bit theater poor for art houses?
We are. There's a desire there for it, but people just don't go out and support it. You know,
yeah.
we saw when the Greenway closed down, and they showed quality movies, and now with the Angelica struggling week to week.
Yes. And they show a lot of and I'm not upset that they show.
There's nothing against
right.
that. I mean, they're a 12 screen theater that has to pay the bills, and
yes.
you know they do play more upscale films, but the reality is that people aren't supporting the smaller films, so they're in and out week after week, and
yeah.
it's a shame. It's heartbreaking that you know. For such a large market, we don't have that kind of support for smaller films. But when you also look at it like from the MFA standpoint, you know, I was talking with Ray at the MFA that their film series rivals that of New York. You know, they are actually, this past summer, their Lantwave outgrossed the museums in New York. And it's amazing that for a market like us to outgross them.
Yes, that is. And still, they, you know, it's great because there's an occasional gay film there. Like Word is Out, they played the...
Yes, the documentary.
The documentary, what do you call it? They redid it.
The re-release.
Re-released it. Well, I guess they also like you wouldn't probably know the word. They sort of redid it from the negative.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. I
yes.
thought they just had an original print, but I didn't know that they
well,
cut
apparently
a new one.
The original print was in bad condition. So I guess I don't know exactly. So let's focus a little bit on your store, and we saw the two other stores in the neighborhood go out of business.
Yeah.
And I know Blockbuster nationally must be struggling.
They're closing locations left and right. I mean, just last week there was an article about how they're filing for bankruptcy soon, and they're closing an additional, 500 locations?
Right. Something like that, yeah.
Yet Netflix has been very successful.
They have been successful, but when you break down the numbers to market-wise, I mean, they have about 11 million subscribers, so you break that percentage-wise. Even for my store, I have a lot of customers who rent Netflix and still come to me, like under their supplemental video store.
Okay. And what do you supplement that?
Mostly TV shows. Like, the people don't have patience to wait for that next DVD
yeah.
of their latest craze on TV, and they just come in and rent it from my store. And I carry a pretty healthy selection of TV shows.
Yeah, and I see on your website you had, like, Mad Men, which, of course, I absolutely
I'm in the middle of season 3, and I'm anxiously waiting for my next disc to come
in. How about Glee?
I have Glee.
You have Glee?
Yes.
Oh, the first season of Glee. Okay.
The second half of season 1 starts next month.
I know.
We're right there. but with my store is... the attitude behind the store is mostly because I'm a film nerd myself. You know, mm-hmm. I don't consider myself pretentious anyway, but I watch all types of movies. I mean, one of my favorite movies is Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion. I love that movie from beginning to end. I've seen it at least 20 times. But I enjoy movies as a whole, you know, so I try to watch as many movies as I can. And, you know, I did intend to spoil my customers with this whenever I opened the store, but now it's gotten in the habit where people just come in and just ask me for suggestions. So I've conditioned my customers just to come in and ask for something. And most of the time, I hit it on the mark. They like what I recommend. Sometimes, though, I burn them, and I feel really guilty about that. But, you know, that's part of the trade. You know, they come in with recommendations. Sometimes they like it. Sometimes they don't. But the main objective of the store is just to be a place where a casual viewer can come in and pick out a good movie, or a film nerd can come in and just be, you know, surrounded by good stuff.
And is there, what do you specialize in? I mean, I know you're trying to cover as much as you can, but because you're right in the Montrose on West Alabama, what is your...
Well, I'm on Richmond and Yupon.
Oh, okay.
I'm on Richmond, my two cross streets, it's Mandel and Mandel and Montrose. So I'm on Richmond, Mandel and Montrose.
Oh, okay. Now nowhere.
I don't necessarily have a niche, like I don't specialize in documentaries or so on and so on, but I mean the reality of the business that I have to bank on new releases, so I carry a lot of new releases.
Sure.
But within the new releases, I try to carry stuff that, you know, people can be proud of to watch, and, you know, they walk away and say, that was a good movie. With my older stuff, you know, I just try to find things that people can find interesting. You know, I would love to beef up my other sections, but that's going to come with time, you know. Cactus and Hollywood, those locations had 10, 15 years on me. So
sure.
Right now, we crossed the three-year mark in October. I'm hoping that in the next year, year and a half, I can, you know, beef up those independent sections. But in the last 6 months, I've been able to really beef up on new releases, which that's the best thing for me, because people come in and they're instantly satisfied. You know, watching a movie, it's about the timing. You know, you're in the mood, let's go watch a movie. If you come in and don't find what you want, you eventually get burned enough times that you're not going to come back. So I've been fortunate enough that I can meet demand.
Now, one of the things is that, do you really see that the store, you know, is always going to be there? There's always going to be that store. Sort of like the bookstore, you know, the books are out, you know, they've got TV.
They have the Kindle.
But you still have bookstores.
Yeah.
And so you see this is always going to be there.
I think in this neighborhood, there should always be something like this. You know, it was heartbreaking when the Hollywood broke down. It benefited my store. Like, I got a lot of customers from that, but for the customer, it's terrible that now you're having less and less options for you, the consumer, to find what you're looking for. Because I refer people to Audio Video Plus, to Cactus all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But with them gone, it makes it harder for you to find what you're looking for. And that's a shame, because what I'm doing this because I want people to be able to watch what they want to watch. But I think in this neighborhood, there should always be something like that. If I would open my store in Spring or Pasadena, I would have not lasted this long.
No.
I definitely would have lasted long. And, you know, with the support that I've gotten with just the neighborhood and being a gay business owner, I love what I do, but I don't try to make that the selling point. Like, I want people to come in and just enjoy for the video store. Because I'm gay, it's the business that comes with that is great, but I try not to, like, bank on that because I don't, you know, not to say that I want to alienate people from that, but my objective is to show, you know, share good films with other people. And that sometimes the gay films can find their way from the gay and lesbian section or documentaries or foreign films. But it's the big thing, big picture for me is just loving movies.
Well, and GLBT people don't just watch gay movies either.
Which is fantastic. You know, I have a good number of gay GLBT customers that they come in and they're open to anything. And I love it that they do that, because I have a few that only stick to gay films. I'm like, but you're still supporting the gay business. So even if you don't rent a gay movie, you can rent anything else that will still support the business. But they come in, and, you know, I understand that. But that becomes one of those things where I carry all gay releases as they come out, but the demand isn't there for them. Like, there's not enough gay films being produced. And, you know, by me as the vendor carrying the movies, I'm obviously supporting that distributor or that filmmaker or whatever. But, you know, there still needs to be more demand for that. And I completely respect that. You know, there's TV show, new releases are my biggest section in the store. That produces at least 65-70% of my revenue. Next to that is TV shows. It would be nice to have more GLBT TV shows to be able to kind of bank on, and not necessarily from my point of view as a business, but just as a community that we can stand behind. You know, it'd be nice to have those Mad Men's and True Bloods that are geared towards the GLBT community.
But there's an awful lot of non-GLBT things that do have themes in it.
Yeah,
I mean, even in Mad Men, they had a theme about a gay man back in the 60s.
Yep.
And of course, it was not very positive, but that was the time. of course, they're not very positive about women either, or minorities, but that was the time. They're reflecting what the time was about.
No, I agree. And I think with shows like Noah's Ark, and you have shows like Rick and Steve, the happiest gay couple in the world, those are fun shows that, you know, you can say that these were aimed for us. And, Noah's Ark, as fluff of a show that is, I love it from beginning to end. I had a lot of fun watching that show.
So now, do you also sell or just rent?
It's all rentals right now.
Okay.
You know, I hopefully eventually get into selling, but the reality for me is that it's expensive to hold cash in stock like that if it's not moving. At least with rentals, they'll turn a profit within a couple of weeks for me. So that's not a, you know, that doesn't hurt too much. But sell through, it's a little tougher to get into that market.
And is it all DVD?
Yeah, it's all DVDs. I tried doing VHS, but, you know, considering that Audio Video Plus specializes in only VHS, I'd rather just send them the business. You know, I'm not going to try to compete with that. You know, they're the only other local video store in the neighborhood, and they have, what, 60, 80,000 titles? They're all on VHS.
Yeah.
But it's an amazing selection.
Yeah.
But it's all on VHS. So I send people their way all the time. So, I gave up my VHS selection, but I specialize in only DVD at my store now.
And are there other independent stores like you in Houston?
In this neighborhood? No. There are. I drive around. That's one of my favorite things to do if I'm driving around in the southeast side or in the north side. And if I see a video store, I always like to just stop by and see what it's like in there. There are other independent video stores. There are. But
there may be some ethnic stores, too.
Yeah, there are. But for what I'm trying to achieve, for what the void that I'm trying to fill, that Cactus left, and now that Hollywood left, no, there's nothing else like that in Houston. I mean, these are just niche stores that are just small neighborhood stores that aren't trying to carry a huge selection. They bank on just new releases. I'm trying to build where you can walk in and have a variety from the older, from foreign films and classics. They, as soon as it's off the new release section, they'll just sell them.
Right. Rob Arros is with us, and he is owner. What's the name of the store?
It's Movies The Store.
Fabulous. And your location?
It's 1407 Richmond, between Mandel and Montrose.
And your hours?
I'm pretty much open every day from noon to 10. Fridays and Saturdays is 11 to 11.
Wow, that's great.
It's a one-man show, so most likely I'll be there when you come by.
Great. Well, Rob, thank you for joining us. You're listening to Queer Voices.
You can drive away home through the electric grids and concrete towers just 2 seconds away after saluting a U.S. Civil Warrior who fought like a man in a rainbow minute. That's all coming up later in the program. By day, Peter Neofotis was a contributing author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. That gig had him on the team that shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore. Meanwhile, Neofotis was moonlighting as a writer of short stories. They eventually became the basis of a one-man show at a Greenwich Village cafe. That gig led to the Pirates Alley Faulkner Prize for Best Novella and the 2009 publication of his book, Concord, Virginia, a Southern Town in 11 Stories. Neofotis took a stroll down his unusual career path with our correspondents Dixie Treichel and John Townsend.
When you were writing, did it ever occur to you that you would someday be performing it or reading it aloud?
It was always sort of in the back of my mind that it would be something that would be really fun to do, but who would do it, would it be possible to memorize all this?
The reason I asked you that is when I was reading your book, so many of the stories really lent themselves to being spoken aloud.
Part of the reason it reads well is because I've been able to spend the time to pay such close attention to the words. I think it helps the written form. I know I started revising a lot of the sentences once I started performing. You know, I started by doing the performance kind of accidentally. I sent in one of the stories to a place in Greenwich Village here in New York called Cornelia Street Cafe a few years ago, and they accepted it for a reading, but it's rather hard to get into the place, and they gave me a lead time of 5 months. And I decided I would just memorize the story word for word and perform it for this amateur night. Why not? And when I finished, the cafe asked me then to do a full show. From there, a curator called Earl Dax, who is actually a burlesque curator here in New York, very into the queer scene, he saw me and put me into a theater here in downtown called Dixon Place. And I just continued to perform there. monthly and bringing forth news stories from this small town in Virginia that I sort of have created based on the small town I grew up in.
And what small town was that? Can you tell us?
I'm from Lexington, Virginia, and I went to Columbia, and while I was at Columbia and I would tell people that I was from Lexington, they would immediately say, Massachusetts. And so I was very aware of this shot heard around the world connection between the two names. And so when I was looking for a name to rename Lexington, it only seemed natural that I would pick Concord.
You seem to be influenced by a lot of the Southern Gothic writers.
I very much enjoy Eudora Welty. There's a strong Midwest tradition also for small town stories. And Sherwood Anderson, yes, Winesburg, Ohio. I mean, that was really the model of Concord, Virginia.
I sense the shadows and the ghosts of the Civil War and the antebellum South kind of creep through your work.
They do, and they certainly creep through Concord, Virginia. Lexington, Virginia is the mecca of the Confederacy. Richmond may have been the capital, but Lexington is where Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, the greatest generals of the Confederacy, are both buried.
Have you found any particular challenges or difficulties being an out gay writer in the South?
You know, interestingly, yes. It has been challenging in that if I perform outside of New York, I have to be careful. Felt like I took a little bit of a risk doing The Botanist. I did that story in Asheville, North Carolina. I was there with the North Carolina Stage Company for 2 weeks. And when I finished The Botanist, four people got up and left.
Because there is an openly gay character in that particular story.
Yeah, and I had told the theater that I was doing this, but they were still, you know, and Asheville, North Carolina is known for its large LGBT population.
Right, yeah.
So I was shocked. The theater was shocked, but it was a night in which the Chamber of Commerce had chosen to do a group outing to it. But at the same time, I feel like that's even more
theater.
Reason why I should do the Botanist.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, sure.
The stories themselves, I think, are rather, not conservative, but in terms of the other performers I perform with in the theaters I perform in New York, I am conservative. Earl Dax typically curates burlesque performance, but when I was selected for the theater, I was doing, I think, The Vultures and The Ancients, neither of which have a queer character in them, but he told me that, as Penny Arcade told him, anyone who's ever felt isolated or alone is queer. So I turned around and said, well, then everyone in Concord, Virginia is queer. and that's true. I think all the stories, all the main characters that I chose to write about are people that have felt isolated and alone. So it's been a great experience for me to be a queer performer because I've been able to come with it, I think, with a unique perspective.
That was Peter Neofotis sharing his unique perspectives with Dixie Trykle and John Townsend. His book is called Concord, Virginia, a Southern Town in 11 Stories, and it's published by St. Martin's Press.
Civil War soldier Jenny Hodgers, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Jenny Hodgers was born in Ireland in 1844 and years later came to America as a stowaway. Answering President Lincoln's call for soldiers, she dressed in men's clothes and passed the cursory physical since no undressing was required. She assumed the name Albert Cashier. Assigned to Company G of the 95th Illinois Infantry, Jenny fought in 40 battles over a three-year period. Once she was captured by rebels, but seized the guard's gun and fled back to the Union camp. Living nearly her entire adult life as a man, Jenny collected a veteran's pension and voted in the presidential elections before women had the right to vote. While institutionalized, her gender was discovered and she was forced to dress as a woman for 2 years until her death in 1915. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, John Klein.
J.D. Doyle. You hear my voice during the monthly audiophile music feature on This Way Out. But I'm here now to ask for your support of this one-of-a-kind radio show. Everyone here does it for love, certainly not for financial gain. We think This Way Out offers a priceless, sometimes even life-saving voice heard around the world, celebrating the rich diversity of LGBT experience. Please log on to our website to see how you can help keep us going. Whatever you can offer will be put to good use and truly appreciated. Read all about it at www.thiswayout.org. That's www.thiswayout.org. And thank you.
Sing if you're happy.
A singer and a slammer team up, the singer goes solo, and a gay rocker chimes in. No, it's not a sitcom, it's this month's audiophile.
He is vegan.
She eats steaks.
Lift up to 40, and that's on one arm.
I could barely lift 10.
I'm a tranny boy who's secretly gay.
And sometimes I just can't stand men, so why do I love you when I can't stand you at all? Your oil,
your water,
your cooler,
your hotter.
So I ain't got a clue. You make me take the gigs that I don't want to take.
You told me to meet you, then you're 3 hours late.
It sounds crazy, but I just can't wait to spend the next 1 week on the road with you.
And being on the road is how the good Asian drivers came up with their name. Hi, I'm Chris Wilson.
I'm J.D. Doyle, and you're listening to Audiophile. Good Asian Drivers are the performing duo of Melissa Lee and slam poet Kit Yan, who have a new album.
Drive Away Home is the Good Asian Drivers' debut album of 2009. It features a collection of stories, songs, and poems from the road with themes of feminism and queer community and people of color issues, and it's a collaboration between Melissa Lee and I. And it's just a really fun album that we're incredibly excited about.
It's microphone night, and dim lights make for good karaoke. Hey, this is my town, where feminists rule and old school is cool again, and new school's working through lots of identity issues. But it is an open door policy in gay or queer nation, so come in with your red, black, orange, green, blue, yellow handkerchiefs dangling out of your back pockets or wrapped around your neck. With your fag ties, your skinny ties, your tie-dye, your cuffs, pants, your trucker hats, your mohawks and faux hawks, your red socks, your hard tacks, and your soft tacks. Just bring it.
The Good Asian Drivers bring us excellent songs and slam poetry. Find out more about the album, Drive Away Home, at www.goodasiandrivers.com.
And we also want to showcase the solo album by Melissa Lee called 2 Seconds Away.
I'm 2 seconds away from heaven and falling off the face of the earth. I got fear in my guitar as company and hypocrite written on the back of my shirt. This halo can't be so uncomfortable. Mind if I take it off for a while? But in the back room, they take one shot. Yeah, but I forgot where I put my smile. But sometimes I daydream about everything I get.
Melissa Lee is known for her very honest lyrics.
2 Seconds Away is my debut album, and it features songs about, you know, my relationships on love and loss and everything in between, and it's a pop rock album.
11:30 in the morning on Pennsylvania Avenue, she was writing when I sauntered over. She said, girl, I almost didn't recognize you, and we didn't kiss and we didn't linger. We pushed the situation away with our eyes. When I asked her what she'd been to write, and she said the 40 different ways we could say goodbye, and she's got a thousand holes in her heart, and she's trying to complete her with a thousand men.
You can also find out about the CD 2 Seconds Away by Melissa Lee at www.goodasiandrivers.com.
I convinced myself you're
the chase. Just as we're about to tangle, you're running away. You don't love, you go for a ride. You say you gotta breathe. And I know you'll never be mine. You say you gotta breathe. Well, you're not quite a baby, but your touch is unmistakable. Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah.
The second CD by Chicago artist Dylan Rice is called Electric Grids and Concrete Towers.
The title for me evokes a sense of being dwarfed by my surroundings, living in the big city, of loneliness, but also of awe of my surroundings. And the music, I think, is trying to show the tension between the two worlds of the natural world and the urban environment that I live in.
I come from you, 'cause we met on the day I was born. And God like sun, filling every hole with almighty love. Ooh, I followed you, 'cause I found a new religion. Like a tongue wagging, I could lie. You kissed me and opened the door.
You can learn more about the album Electric Grids and Concrete Towers at www.dylanrice.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. Find out more about Audiophile or contact us by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiophile.org.
Audiophile is produced by J.D. Doyle, Chris Wilson, and Christopher David Trentum. I'm J.D. Doyle.
And I'm Chris Wilson. Keep listening.
Congratulations to Audiophile producer host J.D. Doyle for his recently won 2009 Stonewall Society Pride in the Arts Lifetime Achievement in Music Award. Well deserved, J.D. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Linda Birch, Ben Caron, Dixie Treichel, and John Townsend, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with John Klein, and J.D. Doyle, Chris Wilson, and Christopher David Trentum contributed program material. Good Asian Drivers, Melissa Lee, and Dylan Rice performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is only made possible by our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, listen to our podcasts, read the text of this week's news wrap, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alert, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on KFAR Knoxville, Tennessee, 2HOT Cobar, New South Wales, Q Nation FM Cleveland, Ohio, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.
Well, we're missing a little end part of that thing, but we'll continue on. I want to congratulate Ray Hill on his 30th anniversary of the prison program. There was a really nice write-up in Friday's Chronicle. Alan Turner just does some wonderful stuff. Take a look at it if you can go get online. And Ray is just a master at what he does, and it's a very unique program to be able to talk. You know, family members can talk to people behind bars, and Ray just does a great job, and his crew, and his entire crew, and that here is here on KPFT at 9 p.m.
on Fridays, and it's been there, and he was. The host on the precursor to our show, which was Waldenstein, in another incarnation, our show. And we owe that to Ray. And Ray was one of the original people who were here at KPFT 40 years ago, which is another miracle.
Well, and, you know, there's been continuous GLBT programming on KPFT since 1975. So I guess that is like 35 years worth of programming that's been done here, although not the same people. The other thing that's going on that there's been a lot of press about is the scandal in the Catholic Church, which is really, really pretty pathetic.
Yes.
Not only the fact that it happened, and it happened in multiple countries, but the fact that it was covered up so much.
Oh, yes.
And that the Pope, basically, the only thing I understand that he did was write one little paragraph in a letter apologizing for it. You know, I think if there was more women in the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, I think this thing would have been dealt with.
Oh, absolutely. And in the case of this one particularly, the victims had been complaining and protesting to get, and the law, the DA's office, said, no, that's a church issue.
And basically they were protecting the priest, the Catholic, you know, clergy, over the young victims.
Exactly.
It's just unbelievable that the authorities, whether in this country or especially in Ireland, just didn't take this into their own hands. And, like, you know, in this case, maybe the church should have just been shut down for the child sex abuse that they did commit.
Oh, absolutely. And the talk, the complaints that the Pope needed to do more, and he hasn't. And that's a shame. It's something that is traumatic, and if you have been a victim, then it's very traumatic, and you carry it with you the rest of your life. And
right.
No matter. And I speak personally. You know, when it happens, you carry it with you the rest of your life.
I also want to congratulate the Obama for and his work and the work in the House and the Senate to finally pass the health care bill. It's not all of what we all wanted, but at least it's a start, and they worked very hard to do that. Despite the misinformation that sometimes is in the other side, a friend of mine, apparently has a gold card. Says, I don't want the government taking the gold health card from the Harris County Hospital District. I don't want the government taking over my health care. That is the government.
That is.
We want to thank our guests tonight, which include guests from Bayou City Performing Arts, Rob Arros of the Movies, which he has a wonderful little store here in the Montrose. And our other guests, which include the weekend holiday Easter.
Yes, Bunnies on the Bayou.
And Bayou, yes. And the Jungle Party.
As well as the performing arts that was
and
the Dianas in the first segment. It was great. You know, the people have been around a long time. We want to thank all our guests tonight. And this is Queer Voices.
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 9 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles, and J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, which is produced in Houston. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Falinski. On-air voices are Brian Levinka, Jennifer Renee, J.D. Doyle, Glenn Holt, Summer Iman, and Jack Valensky. For more information about tonight's program, including links to websites and organizations mentioned during the show, visit queervoices.org. And you can send email to jack@queervoices.org. Be sure to listen to KPFT every Sunday morning, starting at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston, a Pacifica Foundation station. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Your family are invited to Bluegrass by the Tracks at the Houston Railroad Museum on Saturday, April 10th from noon to 6. Yes, Houston does have a railroad museum with a fine collection of vintage rail equipment in a wooded setting in Northeast Houston. And on April 10th, the Lone Star Bluegrass Band, Digger Davis, Tombstone, and other musical groups will entertain all afternoon to benefit the museum. There will be food, fun, museum tours, and toys for the kids. And a rail fair with a model railroad flea market. Old trains, bluegrass music. It doesn't get any better than that. Saturday, April 10th, noon to 6 p.m. at the Houston Railroad Museum, located at 7390 Mesa Road. You can find additional information on the museum at HoustonRRMuseum.org. This is KPFT Houston. Join DEA, serving South Asian victims of domestic violence, to celebrate their 14th anniversary and fundraiser gala, Seeds of Hope, taking place on Sunday, March 28th at 5 p.m., located at Chateau Crystal, 2517 Gessner Road, Houston, Texas, 77063. There will be a featured comedian, and Houston International Folk Dancers will be the featured performers. In 2009, DEA received nearly 4,000 calls for help and served 215 victims of domestic violence. All proceeds from
the free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.